Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has three causes on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Triplex Communications Incorporated doing business as radio station KUZZ 95 FM versus James R. Riley, Mary Gray, Deep East Texas Self-Insurance Fund from Jefferson County. Global Services Incorporated, Steve Eifert, Alfred Vera, and Herbert Michael Mueller versus the Honorable Richard Bianchi, Judge on original mandamus proceedings. And Bruce Wiener, M.D. versus Emmanuel Watson from Harris County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of this time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of our court for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear from petitioner in Triplex versus Riley.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Keith Thibodeau will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I represent the petitioner, Triplex Communications, which I will refer to as KZZB 95 FM, a radio station. The procedural background of this case is as follows. The respondents are police officers who were injured while investigating an accident. They were struck by Mr. Stevens, who was an intoxicated patron of the Palace, which was a defendant in the underlying action, but is not a petitioner in this action. The defendants in the underlying action were the Palace, which was the bar owner, the tavern, and B95 radio station. B95 advertised ladies' night at the Palace, which was essentially a happy hour with reduced price drinks. The case was tried to a jury. The jury rendered a verdict in excess of $1 million against the Palace and a take-nothing verdict against the radio station B95. On a civil conspiracy theory, the jury failed to find civil conspiracy against B95. The Court of Appeals reversed and remanded this case for a new trial. Now, there are three issues in this appeal. The first is whether the trial court erred in refusing to submit a negligent promotion theory imported from the state of California and akin to a negligent publication theory that was recognized by the 11th Circuit in the Braun case. The second issue is whether the civil conspiracy to be negligent cause of action that was submitted by the trial court was proper and which the jury answered in the negative in our favor. The third issue is joint enterprise, whether the trial court erred in failing to submit an issue of joint enterprise. Now, I'd like to make one observation that I think underpins this case, and that is in each liquor liability case, at common law, it has always been assumed that the actor, the drinker, the imbiber of alcohol is the proximate cause of injuries to third parties. Now, where this court or the legislature has deviated from that common law rule, it has been in very specific circumstances. And that is when, and that is to impose liability against the person who is in control of the alcohol supply and who served it. Now, in this case, it is undisputed that B95 did not control security at the Palace, did not control the liquor supply, did not control the service, did not control the admission or ejection of patrons, and did not set the prices. I believe it was Samuel Johnson that said, there's nothing like a hanging in the morning that concentrates the mind. And as I read the briefs last night, I looked critically at where maybe I could have made some points better. So I'm going to start with the negligent promotion theory first. The crux of the analysis of the negligent promotion theory is this. It's based on the Wyrum versus RKO case from California, where there was an incitement to illegal activity, that is basically racing to find a disc jockey in order to win money. Now, as I indicated, except in limited circumstances, this case, this court has found that there's no obligation to control the conduct of third parties that are not under someone's supervision and control. B95 did not supervise or control or assume any duty to supervise or control the provision of liquor or the conduct of patrons at the palace. So there simply was no duty in this case. There's no basis upon which to find a duty for B95. This court has imposed duties on the providers of alcohol. The legislature has imposed duties on licensees and permittees which provide alcohol. And this court has imposed a duty on an employer which sent an intoxicated employee home in the Otis Engineering case. But this is a step further. And there is no basis for imposing a duty on B95 to supervise the control and conduct of the patrons of the palace. In fact, it doesn't make sense. Bars and taverns are required to have their servers take courses in how to spot intoxicated individuals, how to deal with them. B95 didn't have adequate personnel there to do that, and it simply wouldn't make sense to impose a duty on B95 in this case. Now, the Court of Appeals engaged in a risk versus utility analysis. Now, I submit that commercial free speech considerations are relevant when one considers risk versus utility. And the Fifth Circuit has recognized in a case construing this Texas law that advertising has a place in society and has social utility. Now, I know that the respondent is going to get up and say, well, look, this is advertising alcohol, and that's a bad thing. But, you know, in our society...
Does this case contain the same element that the California case you cited about incitement?
No, sir. It's my position that it does not. There was no evidence that this radio station incited or encouraged reckless drinking or overindulgence. In fact, the respondent's expert witness conceded that in his deposition and in his testimony at trial.
The radio station write the script?
The radio station wrote the script, but it was approved by the palace. Then the palace had the right to veto it. The palace had the right to set the drink prices. Now, recognizing that in our society, we do advertise things that are capable of misuse. We permit the advertisement of guns, alcohol, things of what we might view relatively small social utility. Hang gliders. I mean, that's a risky sport, but we permit the advertising of hang gliders. We allow newspapers to advertise guns, billboards to advertise Scotch whiskey. We allow radio stations to have live promotions at car lots or at charitable events. If this court adopts the duty that the respondents ask it to, then where does it end? It is so broad and ill-defined, this duty of, quote, negligent promotion. Does this mean that any advertiser of a product is going to have to investigate the safety of its product, the advertiser take upon itself? Does it mean that someone who puts up on a billboard a Scotch whiskey sign, which induces someone to buy alcohol, who then is involved in a wreck, that the advertiser is liable? Does it mean that in laudable events, a charitable event, a live promotion of a March of Dimes event, that the promoter, if something goes awry at the event, is somehow liable? It's a very broad and ill-defined cause of action that the respondents ask you to adopt. Now, what they're going to say is, well, this is different than advertising. This is self-promotion because the radio station's name was associated with this event. I submit that that is not pivotal in this case for this reason. Anytime a newspaper is published and has an advertisement, anytime a magazine or TV engages in advertising, is it not promoting itself? Of course it is. A newspaper is always promoting itself. A TV station is always promoting itself. So this idea of self-promotion is not essential to the concept of negligent promotion. Finally, and very briefly, there was no evidence of negligent promotion in this case. There was expert testimony that there was no violation of TABC rules that the TABC expects the tavern to control the advertising. The expert witness for the plaintiff testified that nothing in the advertising encouraged overindulgence and reckless behavior, and that B95 was not the proximate cause of the wrecks. The expert witness for the respondents placed no significance on the drink price coinciding with the frequency of the radio station. In fact, there were 95-cent drinks on other days of the week that were not B95 nights. That was the regular bar price. And in fact, all of the station personnel, and there were only two, were gone by 10:30, and there was no evidence that Mr. Stevens was intoxicated by 10:30. There was no one from the radio station even there to see these people being served alcohol. By the time the evidence showed they became intoxicated. Finally, the Braun and the Wearham cases, in my view, are distinguishable. They are clear incitements to illegal activity. In the Braun case, it was a Soldier of Fortune advertisement, and it showed that this man was ready, willing, and able to commit crimes, that he was solicited. And in Wearham, there was an incitement, I mean a direct incitement for minors to race to a location to win money by a disc jockey. Now, let's move to the civil conspiracy theory. And it was all predicated upon the Rogers opinion of the Court of Appeals of Beaumont, which said you could conspire to be negligent. First issue, the trial court assumed that was the governing law and that it's correct, you could conspire to be negligent. And so it assumed that when it submitted the issue. The court can find on page 29 of my brief the issue that the trial court submitted. The trial court submitted the truth of the proposition that you can conspire to be negligent, which I take opposition to. But even assuming that, the submitted question and definition...
That was not objected to.
That was objected to.
You objected to that at the trial court, right?
Yes.
Excuse me.
The submitted question and definition tracked Schlumberger and versus Nortex and Massey versus Armco Steel, which are the seminal Supreme Court cases defining what it takes to conspire to be negligent. Both were intentional tort cases. But the two points I want to draw out of those cases that are important is there has to be a conspiracy to accomplish an unlawful purpose or a lawful purpose by unlawful means. And there has to be a preconceived plan and unity of design, that is, a common design. And it is axiomatic that one without knowledge of the object and purpose of the conspiracy cannot be a co-conspirator. So now let's look at what the trial court submitted. It said, paraphrasing, that it's a combination between persons to accomplish an unlawful or negligent purpose or to accomplish a lawful purpose by unlawful or negligent means. So the trial court assumed that you could conspire to be negligent when it submitted this issue. And that issue was answered adversely to the respondents. So even assuming, Your Honors, that you can conspire to be negligent, the jury responded negatively in my favor on that particular issue. But I'm going to go further than that and submit that the court ought to meet this issue head on, whether you can conspire to be negligent, and I submit to you that you cannot. The Court of Appeals holding in this case would permit an inadvertent conspiracy. This language is drawn directly from the Court of Appeals opinion. It said, we only require that you intend to engage in a course of conduct as opposed to intent to accomplish an unlawful or negligent result. Now think about that. That means that if two deer hunters get together, decide they're going to go deer hunting, they're going to split the meat, they both go off in separate stands, and one doesn't know that the other one is going to do something negligent, the other one's negligent and shoots someone, that they're in a conspiracy. That's all the Court of Appeals required, is to engage in a course of conduct as opposed to the intent to accomplish an unlawful or negligent result. I think the Rogers case should be overruled. By definition, negligence is not an intentional tort. How can one conspire to be negligent? It is such an amorphous concept, I don't know how to even address that. But you've got, by definition, an unintentional tort, negligence. How can you intend to be negligent? Now, there's some language from Aiken versus Dahl, a Supreme Court case that is pure dicta, that implies, Aiken versus Dahl is a malicious prosecution case, and this dicta discusses whether, in the conspiracy case, whether if there's just a finding of negligence, what additional findings are necessary for punitive damages. But Aiken versus Dahl did not establish that you can conspire to be negligent. So I think the court should overrule Rogers and hold that you cannot conspire to be negligent in the state of Texas. Finally, on the civil conspiracy issue, the issue submitted by the respondents was not substantially correct, and that was their burden. And remember, the issue submitted by the court is reviewable only by for abuse of discretion. And I submit to you that the issue, the court could hold in my favor based upon the issue submitted by the court that was answered favorably to me. But the question and definition submitted by the respondents was not substantially correct because it omitted proximate causation. And that, under the Massey case, is a critical element. Finally, Your Honors, on the joint enterprise issue, the pivotal issue is that they want to use this nebulous idea of joint enterprise, but the pivotal issue is who controlled the liquor supply.
You may eat into your rebuttal
time. Yes, all right. The critical issue is who controlled the admission, the ejection of patrons, the security, the drink prices, and the service of alcohol. And B95 did not sell, serve, or provide alcohol. It wasn't a licensee. It wasn't trained to. It wasn't expected to. And in fact, it doesn't make sense to impose that liability. And Justice Cornyn recognized that when he wrote the Graff versus Beard opinion, that at least in social host context, it's very hard to determine when people are intoxicated, keep track of them, and that sort of thing. And it didn't make sense in this context for the radio station to do that. Now, there's two problems with the respondent's reasoning on joint enterprise. One is the vague notion of enterprise. The focus shouldn't be on this amorphous notion of enterprise, but should be on who was the provider and were we in a joint enterprise with the provider. And secondly, they misconstrue the joint enterprise cases. Both Shoemaker and Reed versus Williams require an equal right to direct and control the operation of the conveyance. They seize on language, the respondents, about an equal voice. But both Reed and Shoemaker involve the operation of conveyances by joint owners who had a legal right to direct and control. We, the radio station, had no legal right to direct and control the provision of alcohol, and that was conceded by the plaintiff, by the respondent's expert. He said basically that we can make suggestions that may or may not be followed by the palace, and that it, in fact, he said it didn't make sense to impose the duty to control the alcohol supply on the radio station. This was the respondent's own expert testimony. Again, as I've noted, all radio station employees were gone by 10:30 that night. There's no evidence that Stevens, who struck the police officers, was intoxicated by that time. In conclusion, this is certainly an emotional case. I see these police officers at Luby's cafeteria sometimes, and I hate that they were injured. But when you go beyond the facts of this case and the emotional aspect of it, and the fact that it involves alcohol, and you apply the law of this state, the petitioner should prevail in this case, and the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reversed.
Is the judgment the officers received against the defendants worthless? Is it collectible, or what's the problem?
Your Honor, I don't know if it's a matter of record, but I think that the palace is judgment-proof, yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. How much time is remaining for rebuttal?
2.5 minutes, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Joe Michael Dodds will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. I'm Mike Dodson, and along with Tom Peterson, we represent the respondents, James Riley and Mary Gray, two Beaumont police officers who were hurt seriously in the accident that's made the basis of this case. I want to say at the outset that this is not a case about mere advertising. This is a case about vicarious liability. It's a case in which two businesses combined together in a commercial enterprise that lasted 7 or 8 years. It was a commercial enterprise in which they promoted each other, and they promoted their particular interests to their mutual economic benefit. It was an ongoing enterprise that had a life of its own. And in the words of Chief Justice Walker, in the opinion of the Court of Appeals in this case, it would be hard to conjure a more appropriate factual scenario to which the legal concept, meaning, and definition of the term joint enterprise applies. The evidence in this case was so well developed. If you read other cases involving the concept of joint enterprise, you will not find a case that is so detailed as to the conduct and the involvement of two parties to a joint enterprise. The evidence in this case shows that back in 1982, radio station B95 in Beaumont was a brand new station, just getting started. And they needed something to somehow get public awareness of their station, to improve their ratings, so that they could then increase their prices that they could charge for advertising. One of their salesmen, Mr. Rocky Chase, approached the Palace with the idea of a joint promotion of B95 and the Palace back in 1982.
If the accident had occurred back in 1982, would that affect your case?
No, sir. I don't believe it would. I think
so the fact that it continued over a long period of time really doesn't affect your legal theory.
It doesn't affect the legal theory, but I think it shows the significance of the relationship. But what this promotion focused on was that one day a week, they would have a promotion where there would be 95-cent drinks sold to customers in conjunction with the FM frequency of 95.1 for the radio station. This became so successful that they started selling 95-cent drinks on other nights, but it all started with B95. This relationship...
Isn't it essential to your argument on joint enterprise that there was a joint right of control?
Yes, sir.
And what right of control was there in the radio station of the liquor supply?
Absolutely none. The radio station did not have their hands on the liquor supply and did not serve Mr. Stevens.
Did they have a right of control of the liquor supply?
They had a right to a voice in the enterprise itself. I see, in response to your question, Justice Cornyn, the leading cases on joint enterprise mostly involve conveyances. We have the Ray versus Williams case, which originally the court granted writ and then denied writ. There's another recent case decided November 3rd or 4th of this year from the Houston First Court of Appeals that's not been reported yet, involving a conveyance. But using those cases, this is where this theory has mostly been used in the conveyance systems theory. In the Ray versus Williams case, Mrs. Ray was driving the vehicle. She and her husband were traveling to take some tax papers to their accountant that day. Along the way, they did various things. I think he got a haircut and she went shopping or vice versa. When that accident occurred, Mr. Ray, who was a mere passenger, did not have his hands on the steering wheel. He did not have his feet on the brake or his feet on the pedal, gas pedal. But yet his claim was defeated because it was held in that case that he was involved in a joint enterprise because the taking of the tax papers to their accountant was held to be a commercial purpose.
In this case, it's hard to see how far your argument runs. For example, if the Beaumont Enterprise had advertised this same function at the Palace, would you think you had a cause of action against the paper?
Merely the advertising.
If they'd gone on for a long time and they knew what was going on out there and they knew people regularly got intoxicated and that sort of thing.
No, sir. I don't think this would extend to the Beaumont Enterprise.
What's the difference?
The difference is the Beaumont Enterprise would be mere advertising. They did not become a part of this promotion. This promotion was given the name B95 Ladies Night. It was saturated throughout the week with promo spots.
But if it was a Beaumont Enterprise Ladies Night, it wouldn't make any difference, would it?
You would start finding a little bit different situation if the Beaumont Enterprise started becoming personally involved in the actual promotion itself.
And yet the right of control doesn't change. Whether you're just a mere advertiser
or whether you're actually out there on the premises promoting yourself to, you still don't have any control over the liquor supply.
That's correct.
So if control is the issue, it looks like the theory doesn't work.
Well, I respectfully disagree. Because all that's required for a joint enterprise is that there be a right to a voice in the direction of the enterprise. How can Mr. Ray, in the Ray versus Williams case, have his claim defeated because of theory of vicarious liability when he didn't have his hands on the steering wheel? But yet that's the essence of the joint enterprise theory.
Is that a writ denied case?
Yes, sir. Originally, the court granted error.
Improperly granted.
And then reversed and denied it. But what happened is, this B95 Ladies Night became a virtual institution in the community. Weekly, the liaison between B95 would meet with representatives of the palace. They would write certain advertising scripts that would be played on the radio station that the palace would go over with them. There were other promo spots that the B95 had the right to make on their very own as far as what they had to say about the particular promotion. We had a tape recording that was introduced into evidence that the Court of Appeals set out in some detail in its opinion about one of those ad-lib promo spots that B95 made on the night.
What you're saying is that when you have a joint enterprise, a merger of interests like this, that everyone involved, every party involved, every entity involved doesn't have to have absolute total direction and control over every element of the enterprise to have general control over the overall effort.
That's exactly
the bar didn't have total control over what went out over the radio.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. In the case that I mentioned from the Houston First Court of Appeals, it's a case called Blunt versus Borden. They talk about that in a joint enterprise, parties may bring particular or perform particular tasks. It does not have to be the exact same task. And in our case, Justice Walker made a statement that I thought was a very interesting statement about this very concept. He says that the conception and birth of a joint enterprise begins from common or mutual needs, most times economic in nature, which are best supplied through a combination of respective talents and resources, making possible the pursuit and accomplishments of mutually desired objectives. It's not a requirement that each member of the joint enterprise have an identical contribution to be made, I'm paraphrasing, but they do not have to have identical contributions to the enterprise, and they don't have to receive their benefit from the same cash register.
So a joint economic interest is sufficient?
That they have a community of pecuniary interest is what's required in the joint enterprise.
Joint economic interest would satisfy that?
Yes, sir. Certainly.
So any advertiser would... I guess I'm trying to figure out how far this theory would expand, and why wouldn't not cover anyone who buys advertising, either on a radio station or any sort of joint promotional activity?
Because that becomes a totally separate issue. The benefit to the radio station in this case was not just its advertising revenue that they received from the house. The evidence showed that their primary purpose in suggesting this enterprise from the very beginning was the benefit they would receive from the self-promotion of their radio station.
To make money.
To eventually make money, which would be totally separate and apart from what the palace may make.
They were promoting one another.
They certainly did promote one another, and they promoted themselves.
The bar promoted the radio station promoted the bar.
There was evidence in this...
Was there evidence in the record that the bar had violated liquor laws previously?
Yes, ma'am. There was evidence of other occasions when they did violate the liquor laws. Those were in the TABC records.
Is that important to your theory?
Not really, Your Honor. It was important as to the underlying Ramshop tort, because we had to show that the palace encouraged their bartenders to violate the law to get over the statute. But as to the theory of joint enterprise, it does not make a difference.
If this were a one-shot deal where the radio station were promoting the opening of a new steakhouse or something, and the same thing happened, your theory would apply to that.
It would be less likely to apply to a situation where it's just a one-shot deal, depending on how it's done.
Well, the same thing. 95 cent steaks.
Well, it depends on how the promotion's conducted.
Identical to this one. You know, come on down, folks, 95 cent steaks.
And we're having B95 night here at this restaurant.
Right.
And
yes.
We have T-shirts that show the restaurant and the radio station.
That's right.
You're getting there to where a joint enterprise would apply, Your Honor.
Do you make any contention that the radio station knew Stevens was intoxicated?
Not that they knew that Stevens was intoxicated, but there was evidence in the record from some of the disc jockeys that on other occasions they had seen underage persons drinking openly. They had seen intoxicated persons being served alcohol and yet did nothing. And we felt that that was significant as it applied to the radio station, because with that knowledge, they continued with this saturated promotion of these live remotes from the palace that night, where they would tell people, it's B95 ladies' night, every Thursday night we have this, the crowd's forming, we've got our disc jockeys here, they're spinning the tunes, we've got our mascot here, we're handing out free gifts, we're having a great time, come join us.
All right, sending, let me ask you this question. If the server knew those same facts, the same facts that you've just described, but did not know, and it was not obvious to the server that Stevens was intoxicated, would the server have liability under the Texas liquor laws?
Under the Texas liquor laws, if he did not know, or it was not apparent, or shouldn't have been apparent to him, that the person he served was intoxicated, I don't see that there would be liability.
Notwithstanding all the other facts that you've told us about.
If a server knew that other people had been served before, on other occasions, and on a particular occasion did not know about this one individual, I don't think he would meet the underlying statute.
Now let me ask you this question. If the radio station had libeled somebody that night in its broadcast, had defamed somebody over the air, a patron that they saw there or something like that, would the bar be liable under the joint enterprise theory for that defamation?
If it was in furtherance of the enterprise, they very well may. It would depend on the particular circumstances of which that was made.
So if they saw somebody sitting over here, they saw somebody who wasn't a public figure, just an ordinary business person sitting there in the bar, and they said, here sits old Smith, and everybody knows he's a crook, but he's here, and he sued him for defamation, the bar might be liable.
That's very similar to the case from Oklahoma that we cited, the Floor versus Reflections, where a woman sued for misrepresentations, and I believe there was some defamation in that cause of action as well. And in that situation, Supreme Court of Oklahoma held that there was that they talked in terms of a joint venture between a radio station, a clothing store, and a tavern, and that did apply to that situation. In this case, though, this showed that they had such promotional activities as car giveaways, where they would, the first one was suggested by B95 back in 1984, I believe. The second one by the Palace in 88. In the 1988 car giveaway, the Palace purchased the vehicle through B95. They had promotions where they would have an image of the car with both B95 and the Palace's logo. They gave away beer mugs and T-shirts. They gave away other free gifts. And we're saying that a radio station can't get as involved as this one did in this case. And when something goes wrong, just throw their hands up and say, all we were doing was giving advertising. The radio station, I'm sorry.
To follow up Judge Owen's question, do you concede that if you fail to prove that the tavern owner is liable under the dram shop laws, you fail to prove liability against the radio station under the joint enterprise theory?
Yes, sir. In order for there to be liability on a joint enterprise, you first have to be successful in the underlying tort. That is correct.
And you have to establish the liability of the tavern before you can get to the...
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in a nutshell, what do you say the elements of joint enterprise that need to be proven to establish the liability of B95?
You first have to show that there was an agreement between B95 and the palace, either expressed or implied, and that they had a common purpose to be carried out by this enterprise, that they had a community of pecuniary interest in that purpose, and that there was an equal right to a voice in the direction of the enterprise. And the courts have said that all this requires that there be an equal voice to a right of control. You look at the conveyance cases, Ray versus Williams, or the recent Borden's case. In the recent Borden's case, two men went to New Mexico to pick up two racehorses for the driver's father. They were going to take the racehorses back to Houston. The Houston First Court of Appeals, on talking about the right to have an equal right to a voice in the direction, said that because on the first day of their trip to New Mexico, they diverted to Carlsbad, New Mexico, because both of them wanted to see the beauty of the area and had never been there, that that was evidence of an equal right to a voice in the direction of the enterprise.
The key is, according to your argument, that they have an equal right to a voice, overall perpetuation and control of the enterprise, but not particular control over every particular element of it.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor, and that is how the theory of joint enterprise has been applied, and that's what the evidence shows overwhelmingly in the case. That's
it seemed that one of the reasons you would have a joint enterprise is to bring particular contributions from particular directions.
Exactly, Your
Honor. People who do their thing best do them to the complement.
The whole essence of this is a combination of people. Of a combination of interests and entities that come together for a commercial.
In other words, a disc jockey doesn't have to be a bartender.
No, sir.
And the bartender doesn't have to be a disc jockey.
Absolutely.
For them
not.
To collaborate and form a joint enterprise to promote both the dispensing of alcohol and the promotion of the radio station and its advertising rates.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
What if this were a slip and fall case and instead of the tort here being an intoxicated person, someone slipped on ice that was spilled on the floor or water or something spilled on the floor that had been here for a while, would the result be the same? Would the radio station be liable in that slip and fall case?
I believe it very well may, Your Honor. If it is shown that this is on the night that they're having this promotion, that they've had this joint enterprise ongoing, and there is an underlying tort, be it dram shop or slip and fall or assault and battery, that joint enterprise would reach today.
What do you, let's talk about your element of community of pecuniary interest. Is pecuniary interest narrowly defined, meaning that they share profits in the outcome of the enterprise, or is it broadly defined that if either party has hopes of obtaining some sort of monetary gain because of it, that's sufficient to meet community pecuniary interest?
According to the law, as it has been, Your Honor, that is correct. That
so
not
if
that
I was, if I was a IBM, and somebody says, I'd like you to sponsor this hang glider contest, and so IBM puts up a big banner and says, we've contributed $100,000 to put on this hang glider contest. You all come down, and they're going to have the hang glider sponsoring organization, whatever the hang gliders of the world are out there, and they say, we're going to teach you how to fly on hang gliders, and there's an injury. There has been a community of pecuniary interest because IBM, because it's promoting its name, hopes to sell some more computers. That would be sufficient to satisfy your understanding of community interest.
It would depend on the specific facts of how that promotion was carried out, but you would be getting very close to it.
Well, shouldn't our standard be sufficiently defined that people can know ahead of time that they're subjecting themselves to this liability?
The pecuniary interest is that they hope to derive a benefit from it. For example, in the
benefit could be as tenuous as hope to sell computers to people who show up at hang glider expert.
I believe it would. If they became personally involved in this, as the radio station did in this case, I believe that that will be the case.
Okay, the next element, the equal voice in the enterprise. If the voice in the enterprise is simply, we just don't like what you're doing, so we withdraw our sponsorship. Is that your view of equal voice in the enterprise?
That is one way that they could certainly exercise their voice. If, for example, if the radio station would have gone to the palace and said, look, we have seen you serving people who are intoxicated, we've seen you serving underage people, we're getting out of this thing. They have exercised their right to a voice. That's one way that they could have done it.
So,
in addition to the many other ways that they did so in this case.
So IBM sponsorship of this hang glider expo that they're having out there, if someone comes forward and said IBM should have known that that the people who have the certificates to teach hang gliding really weren't properly trained, and because IBM could have withdrawn their sponsorship of this expo and failed to do so, that was sufficient equal voice in the enterprise to hold them liable in joint enterprise.
That along with some of the other facts that you've given me, that's correct. Along the lines of the equal right to a voice and the community of pecuniary interest, in the Borden's case, the passenger in that case, the only evidence of a community of pecuniary interest for him was that he had told one of his family members before he went on that trip that he expected that when he got back, he'd be able to make a payment on an insurance bill. Because his family would be concerned he wouldn't be able to have the money to pay for this. And that was held by that court, the Houston First Court, that was all that was necessary to show a community of pecuniary interest on his part.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, if the radio station knew that Palace was routinely serving underage drinkers 17 rum and cokes at a sitting, and they were driving away in a threat to other people on the highway, would that change your theory of this case as far as the joint enterprise are concerned?
No, sir.
So B-95 can isn't involved, can never be involved in the negligence of the Palace and it is under any hypothetical set of facts?
Not without the right to control the liquor supply. And that was not existent in this case. I think that,
They shouldn't, they could just continue to be involved in a joint promotional effort,
yes,
knowing that the Palace was acting recklessly, perhaps criminally, without incurring any liability?
Well, I don't think there was any evidence of that. If
I understand. I'm just asking how far your theory
assumption
goes.
I suppose at some point there would be some duty, but I don't see it in this case because there's no evidence.
If the advertising said minors will be served for 95 cents? Minors will be served drinks.
Well, that's a different case because then I think they're inciting illegal activity. I mean, it is
well,
clear.
The Court of Appeals seems to think that they advertise, induce patrons to purchase alcoholic beverages irresponsibly.
Well, even though the Court of Appeals felt that way, I don't think there was any evidence that indicated that because at the time, it was legal for 18-year-olds to be admitted to an establishment of this type, and the precautions that the tavern was supposed to be taking was to stamp them, to identify them as minors between the age of 18
well,
and 21.
Well, I think they cite an ad where they say 95-cent drinks for the entire house, minors welcome.
I guess you could take that and say that in someone's mind, they could construe that as meaning that they would be served, but the minor that was served in this case, Mr. Poupart, had never been served before. He testified to that. So he had no expectation of being served.
I do have a follow-up question, Justice Corden. If there were evidence that the radio station had actual knowledge that Stevens was intoxicated, and intoxicated to the degree that he presented a danger to others, would that change your position or change this case?
As uncomfortable as it sounds, I don't think so. I don't think so. Because they weren't in control of the liquor supply. They didn't have personnel there who were trained to deal with intoxicated individuals. And all of that is part of running a tavern and being a licensee and permittee in Texas. I mean, you have to have training courses for the provider on how to deal with people, how to spot them. So as personally distasteful as I find it to say it wouldn't change the case, I don't think it legally does.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court will now take a brief recess.
All right, please rise.